Gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Are we ready?
Boy, I think so. I say boy. Dude, I love Foghorn Leghorn.
Foghorn Leghorn. Yeah.
Now, boy.
I say. I love the thing I love the most about that is that no one talks like that.
No one
in the history of the world has ever talked like that.
But it's so good. Dude, Looney Tunes was something special.
I love Looney Tunes. It holds up.
I should do an intro for the audio podcast, right?
You need to do an intro for the audio podcast.
Are we leaving this in? I think this is perfect. This is so good.
What are we doing here? A podcast?
Yes.
I forget because
we're just doing segments, you know. So, okay. The experience will not be any different for audio podcast listeners.
In a perfect world, it won't be.
Right. That's all Ethan's job. Fix it in post is our motto here. Welcome back to Switchcast Season 5. I'm your host, Doug Tabbitt. I'm looking at the camera for an audio podcast. This is a great start. Here with my co-host, Tyler Sanders, and we are the automotive-related podcast that's not just for car people. That's right. We entertain, educate, and edify you. Well, that's what we claim anyway. We'd like to hear your feedback on whether or not you agree with us. But anyway, and we would love your feedback, actually. Any amount of feedback anywhere on the platforms you're listening, liking, sharing, subscribing, that all helps the algorithms. We've heard from a number of you that it's such a great show. Why aren't more people listening? Well, that's partly up to you, and we will thank you for your help in that manner. Manner, matter, I didn't know which word I wanted to use, so I just conflated them.
Yeah, use them both.
Yes.
Twice as good.
It's like a latte. I don't know if I want milk or coffee.
Both. I want my milk to taste like coffee.
Okay. It's like flavored water. It's just like...
Oh, actually, wait, hold on a second. Are you going to give me crap for flavored water? I love flavored water. It lets me have nice tasting liquid that is not sugary.
No, it doesn't taste that good. It's just, it's very, very weak juice.
Speaking of that, what are you drinking from there, Tyler?
I got some liquid death right here, unflavored.
Well, this will just be on the audio, so it could be a liquid death, could be a LaCroix, could be a Bellevue. We don't
Liquid death isn't paying us, so why are you bragging about it? Yeah.
It could be a LaCroix. We don't know.
You're paying them dearly for the privilege of drinking that specific carbonated water.
I like the carbonated water they provide. They've got a good product, Doug.
Okay. This really sounds like an endorsement and it is bothering me. One, they're not paying us. Two, carbonated water is bad for men's urinary health.
I know. I've got a bunch of anxiety about this now because you mentioned it earlier today.
We are not a health show.
We cannot be sponsored because if I took all the money I spend on liquid death and put it towards something else, I'd probably have a GT3 by now. So
just ask them to give you a refund as a sponsorship. Tonight, we're going to talk about lots of fun things. The best one, this is good. I didn't know whether to put this as a flop of the week or the wall of shame or the shrewd negotiator or all of the above, but here we go. Courtesy of NBC Miami, a man who was allegedly trying to burglarize a sports car. Hold on. I love that they use allegedly here because as you watch the video and see what happens, it becomes abundantly clear that that's what was happening. But of course, you know, it's got to be prosecuted and go through the courts before they can say that he was actually doing it.
I do wonder, they've got to use that word, like you said, but I wonder, like, what else could he possibly have been trying to do? It's like, he's just checking it out.
Well, we'll find out. He was allegedly trying to burglarize a sports car in a Miami Beach parking garage, and he ended up locked inside, and that's how he was caught.
Amazing.
So, just like many situations in which we find ourselves, he could get in, but not get out. We're going to leave that right there and not go any farther with that analogy. A witness saw a man open the door of an unlocked Chevrolet Corvette, sit in the driver's seat, and stay inside. So he called the owner of the car and said, hey, something is going on. And he also called the police. So the owner of the Corvette, Julio Solano, came out. And apparently there's two different There's differing reports depending on which article you read. Solano may have owned a company that rents exotic and luxury vehicles. So if that's the case, he would likely be no stranger to having them stolen, because that seems to be a consistent yeah. theme with exotic car rentals. Another article said that he knew somebody in that garage who also owned an exotic car rental firm, and he alerted them and said, hey, somebody's snooping about trying to allegedly steal cars. So Solano walks up and starts filming because he sees somebody in his car, and he says, my brother, this is not your car. This is my car.
I just love that sentence so much. Just, what, my guy, what's going on? Like, what are you doing?
I can see our friend Bailey Walton walking up. My brother in Christ.
Yes.
This is not your car.
This is my car.
Oh, so the guy's good. Trying to get out. He can't get out. And he asks the owner, Solano, says, hey, man, you got to get out of my car. And the guy in the car says, well, for what? And it starts to get like defensive. This video is stinking hilarious. So the owner says, like, what do you mean? Like, you're trying to steal my car. Get out of the car. And he like holds up the key tag that dealers have on their keys. Like, you know, here's the VIN and stuff like that. That's what it appeared to be to me anyway. And was trying to say like, oh yeah, this is my car. Look, I have this tag.
Yeah.
A tag attached.
So there was no key. It was just the tag.
There's no key. So he couldn't get out of the car. Now, this may sound ridiculous, but let's take a look at, well, modern cars, but Corvettes especially. They have a little button to get in the car, and then they have a little button that you push with your thumb to get out. And if the battery's low or the key's not in it, it doesn't work. And there is a manual release down below. There has to be, right? Well,
I would say we'll I would like to come that. Back to that.
We'll come back to that. There has to be. But he didn't know where it was. So he was trapped inside the car because he either didn't know where the button was or the button was not working because he didn't have the key. Now, how he got in it but not out of it, maybe that's a design flaw, but he got in it, couldn't get out.
I mean, normally when I like, so I know a different car, you know, obviously this person was not used to it. You don't know where everything is. I mean, I know it takes me 12 years to find the gas release on any car I'm not in. Like, I get a rental car and it's like either in the glove box or under the dash or in the back. Like, it's all over the place. So I get cut him a little slack.
If the cops are coming though, I'm going to figure out where it is. I'm going to start pulling and pushing everything to get out of the car. Speaking of the cops finally arrived. Here's the kicker. They ordered the suspect to get out of the car.
Makes sense. I mean,
he could not comply. Yes, the arrest report says, quote, he could not open the door due to an unconventional door mechanism he could not figure out. Oh, man. So they drew their weapons and they opened the door for him. So easy enough. Got him out of the car, arrested him. And according to the article, apparently he had been sent there by whom I don't know. But he had been sent there to pick up a Lamborghini Urus SUV. The name sounds as ugly as the car actually is. But it was locked. From the outside.
Oh, you know, every time I try to go up to a Lamborghini Urus, I'm trying to obtain, I just go to a Corvette if I can't get in it. Easy, right. Every single time.
He also tried to open the door to a Ford Mustang that was also locked until he found the Corvette. So, anyway, he was arrested and
apparently later charged with, and I love this, burglary of an unoccupied conveyance.
Mm. All right. Well, Corvette people everywhere may be also potentially arrested as they are trying to get crazy discounts on Corvette C8s and Z06s. And yeah, dealers are accusing them of theft left and right. So back to the manual door release, right? So this is like a funny haha story, right? This thief is alleged thief is an idiot. And I find it absolutely hilarious that he gets stuck in the car, and that's how he gets caught. To say nothing of the guy that left his Corvette unlocked. Yeah, that's not a good start. There was a guy who died. It took a dark turn.
Ooh, I was going to say, how did we get here?
Older gentleman in a Corvette C6, which was the first generation with the electronic door releases. And he was in a parking lot. I think it was Bob Evans. I may be remembering that incorrectly and just stereotyping in my memory. But he could not get out of the car because I guess his battery died in that scenario. And it was hot out. Oh. And he didn't know where the manual door release was. And this was also caught on video too. It was a heartbreaking video. But he ended up dying of heat stroke. And there's a bunch of people like around the car, and they couldn't get in the car either because both inside and outside, it's an electronic handle. So they couldn't open it because the battery was dead. And opening it from the outside is far more difficult when the battery's dead because you have to have the key and then put it in this little thing above the license plate to open the trunk and then go into the trunk to pull the manual door release. So people can't just randomly get in your car. But obviously they didn't have the key, so they couldn't rescue him. But inside, there's just a door handle, a manual one, down by the floor mat that you pull and you could get out. But he didn't get that training from the salesman, I guess.
I would like to argue that you shouldn't need that training.
You think you should just know where it is?
No, or? Why did we replace something that worked perfectly fine?
This I agree with. I cannot tell you, there has been no end to the frustrations that I've had with Corvette's electronic door handles specifically. They are a pain in the rear. One, battery dies. It's like a three-step process to get in. Two, like half the time you pull it, and if you pull it too much or too little or too quickly or too slow, it like releases but only opens one notch. What? So you do this annoying thing where you're like pulling full strength, but then it stops on its own latch, and so it's just annoying. And then inside, if the car's running or whatever, it locks it. So if you try to get out, you have to then like, find the unlock button. And it's so frustrating.
You know what it's like on my Corvette, Doug? There's just a handle. It's either locked or it's unlocked. There's you pull it and handle. The car opens.
Yes.
Wild concept.
Yes. The only manual door handle I've ever seen confuse anyone is on the G-Body 911s because it's kind of like integrated. It's a design feature. And so I would have a lot of fun when I would give people rides just not telling them where it was and see people struggle and just like this, their desperation would escalate as they are like feeling everything and they'd like twist the door lock thing and be like, this is it. Nope. And they like, I had one person that took like 2 full minutes to get out of a G-body.
And you just let them have ears on?
And just sit there and watch. They didn't have social media back then, so they did. My wife figured it out in like 5 seconds. I was proud of her.
That I feel like that's quicker than most.
Yes.
It took me a little bit my first time, but you know.
Anyway,
we get better.
Yes. Well, shrewd negotiator. This week is what, Tyler?
So this is another beautiful thing coming to us from Facebook. This is in regards to a marketplace listing for a 1983 Jaguar XJS V12.
Sounds like a car I'm selling.
Interesting. Does it really?
Yeah.
This person messaged and said, complete rear brake job is $3,800 plus, according to my Jag mechanic. Paint needs to be stripped. Crow's feet is not a sand and fill job. I've refurbed a few old Jags. Let me know if you come down in price significantly. Thanks.
Keep in mind, this is my Jag. I'm asking a whopping $4,000 for this Jaguar. $4,000 for a running and driving, albeit maybe not stopping very well, V12 Jaguar with a clean title.
I mean, I feel like in today's car market, $4,000 is practically free. It's
pretty
not
much. It's like a few cases of liquid death.
Exactly. Now you see my problem.
Yes. But like 4,000, I don't know what coming down significantly is on $4,000.
Yeah. Like is it 2,000, 1,000, like
$200?
Yeah.
Like what? I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
And then they followed up, you know, later with sell it fast. These are like apples under the tree. They're everywhere. With misspelled there, by the way.
Of course. Ironically, when I was trying to find one, they were not everywhere. All of them were rusty and terrible. Now, the issue with these cars is, yes, the rear brakes are terrible. They're notorious for failing. These ones are pretty rusted out, but it's an inboard brake system. So you have to essentially disassemble the subframe to get to this brake system. So it's like a 30 or 40 hour job.
Holy
right?
moly.
So he's not wrong that it's expensive, but that's baked into the price. Everybody knows that all of them need this. So it's not like he's going to go find one for $5,000 that has fresh rear brakes. I thought it was interesting because I see this trend where people are essentially leading with insulting and just saying, here's all the things wrong with it. You're way off base in price, and thinking that's the way they're going to win me over and like scare me into discounting the car so much. And I don't know how, I just don't care. That negotiation tactic doesn't work on me. Maybe it works on other people, but I just told the guy to go pound sand.
Well, it's like they're doing half of the Ed Bolian way to buy cars. They're doing the here's all the things wrong with it, but they're not following up with the here's why I am the only guy and you should sell it to me. They're just leaving it at the rude part and not actually negotiating.
Well, and Ed Bolian says it in this nice, deep voice, Southern accent, kindly with lots of big words. This guy just went full mean on me.
Thanks. Just love it. Also, yeah. This is like, these are gorgeous cars, but I'm so scared of them. I'm not sure I'd spend $4,000 on one. They terrify me.
I literally only bought it to fill a hole at a car show, and then I'm selling it immediately.
Like, it's gone.
So I'm in at $3,500. If anyone wants it for $3,500, take it off my hands. You should probably tow it away because the rear brakes don't work really at all.
Nuts for Sticks is a brand celebrating the manual transmission in all its forms. So forget those flappy paddles because we like shifting ourselves. Check out our fun and funny stick-themed shirts at nutsforsticks.com and save 10% on your order using the discount code SWITCHCAST. That's nutsforsticks.com and use code SWITCHCAST.
There's always an ongoing debate about whether or not you should buy an X rental car. And there's a lot of strong opinions on that, as well as whether or not you should buy an off-lease car. So having recently rented an ex-rental rental car that is now a Turo car and having a pretty terrible experience, but then also interviewing one of my relatives who works in off-rental sales at a major national corporation and getting some insight from him, I wanted to unpack this a little bit because it is a fairly hot topic. Everybody's always thinking about, well, you know, should I buy a one owner car? Should I buy a three owner car? Should I, or shouldn't I buy a car from a certain region? You know, all these different things that they look for when they make a decision whether or not to buy a car. And rental cars are one of those things. The prevailing opinion, I think, overwhelmingly is no way, rental cars are beat, you know, used hard, put up wet, and there's no way I'd buy a rental car because so many people have driven it hard and everybody abuses them and basically assumes that like every rental car is run in a cannonball or used in Dukes of Hazzard or something like that, which, not going to lie, if I'm renting it, that's a very real, very real possibility. I've taken a few rental cars to the racetrack. I've done things that have violated my rental contracts.
Yeah, I feel like I maybe am concerned less with a rental than I would be with my own car, but I still take care of it because I don't want them to make an insurance claim.
This is true. So I'll relay my experience with Turo and certainly why I would, and I've only had a few experiences with Turo, so this is not across the board, but I've heard that this is far more common, and it makes sense. The general Turo business model for individuals or small companies trying to make money is, well, we'll buy a cheaper luxury car and likely finance it and basically just try to like make the spread, right? So if you buy a brand new car, huge interest rate, or sorry, not interest rate, huge depreciation, big payments, because you're taking all the depreciation that's baked into a new car, it's going to be hard to make that up on your Turo rental fees. But if you can buy a car that looks rich, but you can get fully depreciated, your payments are a lot less, and you can ROI that better. Now, I don't advocate doing this at all on payments. That's just a bad recipe. I've heard too many stories of people that just, they think it's going to be grand, and it isn't. It's not passive income. You have to manage all the renters. You got to deal with all the damage. But I picked up a Camaro from, I think it was GT Lux LLC, which was this family-owned business, so they claimed, at least when I gave them feedback, and then, you know, they wanted me to feel badly for them for not doing their job. But it had been hit multiple times. It looked like it had been repainted outside.
Whoa.
And it had a terrible bend in one of the rims, which my wife just recently got a similar bend in her rim, and it was deemed unsafe to drive by the mechanic until we got a new one.
Whoa. Yeah, those are nothing to really mess around with.
Right. And one of the rear tires, there was three different brands of tires on the car out of four. One of them was totally bald and down to the cords on the inside.
Nice.
Now, when I brought this up to them, they said, oh, well, shoot, we found out just hours before your rental that the previous person was doing burnouts and street racing and, you know, bad activities. And they just blamed it all on him and said, well, we tried to inspect it and the tire looked good from the outside, but you're, you know, we don't rent out vehicles that are unsafe to drive. I'm like, well, I beg to differ.
You are at this moment doing exactly that.
Yes. Just because people don't know any better and don't catch it. But like the front wheel was vibrating like crazy. You know, it was like a constant, you know, lane change assist thing. Just, it was baffling. And I just thought I would never, ever, ever buy an ex Turo rental car. But I think that's the perception that people have of actual rental cars. Like that's how they're treated and, you know, they're just going to get a complete wreck. And I don't think that's really the case, right? So my conversations with my relative who used to work in the rental side of things, so he saw how the fleets were maintained and everything, and now works on the sales side of things, essentially sold me on why I would buy a rental car, because their company, and this may not be the case for everybody, but they buy brand new cars. They maintain them regularly on the maintenance schedule. They have, you know, certain policies in terms of even like for their tires, they can't mismatch treads front to rear. Now they just changed that policy so that they can, but they have to still be within spec and the treads have to be similar and tread wear and all that. So they have policies about the vehicle maintenance, they have to be kept up. So, and most of the cars, despite what car guys think we would all do with rental cars or might do, the average people just drive them. Yeah. And they don't really drive them that much.
You know, they're on vacation, they're out there for work. Like every time I get to rental, it's because I'm going somewhere for work. And right. I like don't care. It's like to the hotel, to where I need to be. And then I back.
I have to try to put a full tank of gas through a rental car. Yeah. So more often than not, I treat a rental car very well and turn it in. And all the regular corporate rental cars I've gotten seem to be really, really nice shape. Like there was no funky surprises, no weird smells. So, yeah, I don't know if people are afraid of the penalty, like you said, but I think this stigma of ex-rental cars should not apply. I've gotten a couple ex-rental cars for my customers, found them on Manheim, OVE, whatever, bought them. They had a couple like little dings and scuffs and stuff, but nothing more than any normal car would.
Well, and I think that's something that is key to remember. I have a little bit of experience with a family member who purchased an ex-rental car through a different kind of situation. Like it looks great, but there was some not really terribly well done paint work and some stuff on some certain areas, but like in rental cars I have seen too, sometimes there's like blemishes or weird things, or people are dragging suitcases over the, like, the entryway to the trunk or to the hatch. Like, just don't expect a perfect car.
Yeah.
Understand that you are accepting, I think, maybe more visual blemishes, but like mechanically they should be fine.
Sure. But couldn't that also be the case with most any used car if you look at it closely?
100%.
Sure. Now, I want to compare that to off-lease cars. Now, if you run a Carfax or similar vehicle history report, now they will show like the value adjustment, right? And there's always been kind of a negative connotation that's on the Carfax report for a leased vehicle. It's like special use. And they kind of lump it in with lease slash rental. Now, again, exotic car rental, ooh, I would never touch one of those, because literally it's people who have no idea what they're doing, who want to experience an amazing car for a day. And boy, oh boy, do those cars just get put through the ringer. I'm talking about like a Mazda, a Toyota, whatever. That's people renting the same type of car that they drive on an everyday basis.
Do you feel the same? So I know some of the bigger like corporate rental car companies have like a luxury, a sports like brand. Do you feel the same about those? Like versus maybe a McLaren rental you find on the strip in Vegas?
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever buy any high-end vehicle that was used as a rental.
So we're talking about appliances.
Yes, appliances. Gotcha. I think that's an important distinction. I appreciate you bringing that up. Yes, I wouldn't ever touch a high-end car that was rented. And maybe that's part of the problem with Turo, is a lot of Turo is like people are trying to rent upscale stuff, because you can get cooler cars on Turo for the same amount of money typically as like a regular car. So it's like the mid-range where you have kind of like the Airbnb exotic car rental type thing.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'd want to buy a house that it was an Airbnb unless it was completely redone.
Rental houses, I would say those are worse.
Ooh.
Total tangent here. We've stayed in a lot of rental houses, and they 100%. Are rental slash flipper spec.
Yep.
Right? Really cheap stuff, whitewashed. Not literally, but, yeah, you know, it's that kind of thing of like, oh, man, there's a lot being covered up here. So, no, I would never, ever, ever buy a house that was like made for Airbnb or Vrbo. No. The cars, yes. But they don't make them different, right? It's not like somebody goes in to a rental car and they're like, eh, I'm going to like rip out the interior and put velour in here because it's cheaper.
We're like, going to get rid of the trunk and put more seats back there so you can fit more people.
Yeah. You don't find that happening. A car is a car is a car. Anyway, so talking about a lease, right? I would almost be more hesitant to buy a lease than I would be to buy a rental car, because the same discussion we've had with number of owners, right? So people want a one owner car versus an eight owner car, because they say, well, eight owner cars aren't taken care of. I would disagree. I'd say odds are that if eight people have owned it, six or seven of them took good care of it, and the one person who didn't own it long enough to damage it. You extrapolate that out with rental cars, and it's like, okay, so 300 people have driven it. Let's say five of them were terrible car people. Well, they didn't put enough miles on it for it to matter. They didn't do anything. They didn't service it on the cheap. They didn't not service it, right? And what my friend who works for the rental car company said is if you look at it a different way, it's not like it's had 300 owners. It's had one owner. If you think of the rental car company as an owner, like, yes, they're letting other people driving it, but they're the ones. The company's the one responsible for the maintenance, for the upkeep, for the ongoing condition of the car.
Well, and I also think it is in their best interest to keep that car reliable and functional and in good condition so that they continue using it for their business.
Sure.
It's not just an owner that's like, well, I can't possibly, I can't put good tires on it, or I can't afford to do this maintenance right now. I'm going to put it off or whatever, right. Or forget, honestly, just forget, right, to do all this stuff. They have a schedule. They need to keep it running so that they can keep making money.
Not only that, but liability. So that we've talked about like fly-by-night transport companies, right? And how you can spot them because their trucks aren't maintained. Well, they don't have as much liability if something goes wrong because of negligence. Same thing with like the mom and pop Turo. If they, like, for instance, if I wreck this Camaro and I could blame it on this tire that was completely unsafe. And if I could hold them liable, they're probably a small enough company with small enough assets that they don't really have anything to lose. They wouldn't be in danger of a giant lawsuit. But these large corporations have to maintain everything to a certain standard, because if they don't, they could face significant liability, not because they are any more culpable than a mom and pop shop, but they have far deeper pockets, so they're a bigger target.
100%.
But back to the lease. I feel like the mindset with leasing is people lease who don't want to maintain their cars. They lease because it's zero hassle. They lease because they can get it for 3 years and trade it in before they have to do an oil change. Or they just do the manufacturer, like, okay, well, it's the free stuff, and they buy the wheel and tire warranties or whatever, and they just, like, they don't want to think about cars.
I have a couple of friends like that, and I would not want to own cars that they have leased or owned. It's just like, I don't,
right.
You do you, I understand. Maintenance is a hassle, you want a new car, whatever, but...
And they only fix things if it's above what might be, like, not allowed in their lease turn-in inspection, right? I had a Honda S2000. It got pretty dinged up. It was leased. It was my first sports car. I beat the snot out of that car. And then I took over somebody else's lease on an S2000 CR. I would never buy either of those cars. Mark my words. And you shouldn't either. Yeah, it was just like, well, screw it. That this damage will be allowable at lease turn in. And I don't care if I put mismatched tires on it, because they won't check that at the lease turn in inspection. It was like, do the bare minimum so that I just don't get charged when I turn it in. And I want to wring every possible ounce of enjoyment and abuse and wear out of this car that I possibly can.
Well, and you still get to pass the buck to somebody else. It kind of comes back to the whole thing, like, a rental car company's got to take care of their stuff. You don't have to take care of your stuff as a lease, because as soon as you get the paperwork signed, it's not your problem.
Right.
The dealer's got to deal with it, or the person they sell it to.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would not buy a high-end X rental car. I would never buy an X Turo / Airbnb rental. I'd never buy an X rental house, but I would buy a run-of-the-mill appliance rental car before I would buy a lease, and maybe on equal par with, like, any other just used car. And I think the point applies, all the stuff we've been saying on this podcast before, is it almost doesn't matter. Every single car, you just have to perform your due diligence regardless of what the metrics are on the vehicle's pass. Number of owners, rental, lease, location. You just do your homework.
Well, I mean, you have found out, unfortunately, that even if you do your homework, sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't pan out.
Yes. No,
I don't want to bring up a sore spot, but, like, you did so many of the right things and it still didn't pan out. And that is just unfortunately.
Let's not talk about past mistakes. Let's talk about future mistakes.
Oh,
let's do a market update. It's been a minute since we've done one of those. So, market update. Tyler's looking for a 996 GT3. So this is a perfect opportunity to take a look at the GT3 market and or the market in general and see what high-end cars are doing.
Yes. So thankfully, it seems that things are continuing to cool a little bit. There have been a couple of 996 GT3s specifically that have come up lately that have had what I will call promising results.
For you.
For me.
Not
the
seller.
If somebody owns these, or, you know, I'll get it from you cheap. There was a cobalt blue, which is a gorgeous color.
Rare.
This is very rare. One that was on Bring a Trailer. It had 96,000 miles. So it's really up there.
Somebody Turo rental, maybe.
This had, like, what I would consider a fantastic spec. Painted back sports seats, blue belts, like, all the full leather, like, a lot of really, really good stuff. So it was going to bring some money. That sold for $90,500, which was, honestly, I think a little lower than both of us thought.
I think I pegged it at 94, yep.
Yeah, because, like, the color, everybody's so much about color.
And they are. I was very disappointed, speaking of things cooling or not cooling, a BMW Z8 in topaz blue over Crema with 1,700 miles recently sold on Bring a Trailer. And I'm trying to pull up the results here, and I do not have internet service. But it was, I believe the first number was a 4. I don't know what the second number was, but it was a staggering result just because blue and low mileage. So that tracks even to a high mileage GT3. There is a premium for Cobalt Blue. So, yeah, it's a $10,000 premium there.
Ooh, Z8 went for $413.
$413. Look at that.
Wow.
My hopes are dashed to buying a Topaz Blue Z8. All right, so we've got that one at $90,500.
And the next one ended just yesterday, I think, or yeah, yesterday, the day before, was a Seal Gray with 81,000 miles. Slight minor damage on Carfax. It seemed to be like rear bumper was repainted, but like nothing crazy. It had the Euro Recaro Sport seats, which people love and pay bunches of money for, that I wouldn't want. But it was like gray, so not as exciting as blue. This sold for $76,000.
That is a deal. I've seen regular 996s in 2022 sell for almost
like,
that.
That is insane. That's like years old pricing. Now, I don't know if there was anything hidden. I followed this, but like, it
seemed
have been
like
that
a
cheap.
Pretty good auction.
Yeah.
It just went cheap,
which is wild. So yes. That one I'm very excited about. Related, kind of interesting. So the third one is a black one that was on P-Car Market that was a demand like build back in 2012. So it was bored out to 3.8 liters, had all this racy stuff, like bunch of work done, and seemed to be really well represented and everything else. That no sailed at 90.
Hmm. 90
grand.
Do you
know what the... So that goes up on Deal Tank, for those of you that don't know. It's the P-Car Market's thing to sell at if a car no sales.
Right.
And I'm guessing that's the reserve they put it at?
Typically, yeah.
125.
Oh, boy.
Which is quite different.
That's a different number than
there's
90.
There's a 996 in between the no sale right. and the price they wanted.
Goodness gracious. Well, and we were looking at the history on that car, too. And 2 years ago, it no sailed on Cars and Bids for, I think, 121 or 122,000. And it appeared to be from the same seller. So, boy, I bet they were wishing they took the high bid at that point.
Seriously.
Yeah. So, absolutely, the market is cooling, not across the board, definitely not on blue BMW Z8, but it has continued to cool on sports cars, and a 996 GT3 is a great example of that. There are, of course, outliers within every single market. For example, the 997 GT3 market is not cooling. It's stronger than it was 6 to 12 months ago, but hey, you know, things just happen.
I'm okay. I'll take the ugly headlights. I don't. Oh, I can feel it. I'm so ready, Doug.
All right.
I'm gonna get one right as it goes into wintertime, and it's gonna be parked in the garage for like 4 months.
If anyone knows of a Magnus Walker quality 996 GT3 for a Magnus Walker price, because he loves to get a deal. I think he paid like 55 or 60 grand for the one he bought.
God, Andy has a GT2.
Ago. Yeah, yeah. So Tyler's on the hunt. This episode is brought to you by Sheffield All Sport Watches. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jay Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield All Sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one in July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid back in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. I love mine. Get yours at SheffieldWatches.com and mention that you heard about them on Switchcast. A question I often get when doing presentations and discussing Cannonball in general is, can the Cannonball record be beaten? Now, my wife gets after me because she says Ken is Barbie's husband and can is how you say whether or not something is possible. But you know
what? I wasn't going to say it.
I'm from Maine. We say can it be done? Even though I live in the Midwest now, and it's a very, well, it's a loaded question, right? It every time somebody has set the record, there's always been a discussion of, can it be beaten? Right. So the cannonball times back in the 70s and 80s, people said that those could never be beaten because of the increase in traffic in modern times and cell phone usage and police anti-speeding detection equipment, et cetera, et cetera. So, but we proved that to be completely false. We obliterated the record, not just us. I mean, Alex Roy and then Ed Boley and then us. So the record has been obliterated many, many times over. But the reason the question has more weight to it now is the most recent cannonball record was set in 2020. It was kind of at the tail end of the pandemic era traffic, but it still happened during quote unquote COVID. So there was a severe reduction in traffic. There was less enforcement depending on the state. Other states had more enforcement, but there's a definitive advantage that we will likely never see again in history. We hopefully won't have a situation like that happen again.
Did you feel that on your run? Less traffic, less, you know?
For the first half of the run, yes. When we got out to the West Coast, it was basically like normal. Okay. And it was almost a vacation rush hour. So in terms of the ideal pandemic era run, we didn't get it, right? We probably could have gone an hour, hour and a half faster if we had a perfect run during the lockdown, but we didn't. So there is time on the table for a perfect run. But let's be honest, there's a number of factors that have changed since then. One, traffic has increased back to at least normal levels. I don't have the data on this, but I would opine that it is higher than normal because I think less people are flying just in general. And just my anecdotal experience is out on the roads, the traffic is the worst it's ever been.
Yeah, my butt dial says there's a lot of people. Butt dino, goodness gracious.
Butt dial is what you do to an ex-girlfriend. Butt dino is what you do with a car after you mod it.
That's why you got to get them numbers out of there, Doug.
Right.
Yeah, it feels so much more congested all the time. I was driving in not a rainstorm, but some pretty significant rain up here over the weekend, and I was shocked at how many people were on the highway.
Yeah. Yeah. And not only that, there are every year that goes by, there's more strict enforcement, there's more strict penalties, there's more laws passed, there's all sorts of different things that happen. But the real question is, can the cannonball record that exists currently set during the pandemic be beaten in a non-pandemic era, right? Yes, there's time left on the table for a perfect run, but is a perfect run different? Does it look different now with full traffic and even more traffic than previously? Also, there is a hiatus on construction projects during the pandemic. And I would even say that when we went the first time in 2019, there was kind of a bunch of big ones coming to an end and kind of a natural break. And then post-pandemic, there was all these pent-up construction projects that had to be done, and it's just construction everywhere now. So it's almost like everything's conspiring against somebody that wanted to go out and set a cannonball record. And the anecdotes are not just that. The data is there. Since 2020, nobody has gone sub 30 hours verified. There's somebody that claimed to go 27 and change solo. It's an interesting claim. We're sorting through the data. Anyway, there's no verified runs under 30 hours, right? So let's just say that the pre-pandemic record, 27 hours and 25 minutes, nobody's even come close to that. So is it possible?
You asking me for my opinion right now?
Yes, I am.
I,
as a non-cannonballer, what do you think?
I think yes. Just at some point, probably in our lives, somebody is going to find a way to do it. But I feel like we have reached a point, and especially after talking with you and with Arnie and being around the community so much more, that all of the things that lent themselves to the records being broken like they were since the 70s are no longer going to be a thing. So like you guys have talked so much about how you chose the right cars, the Mercedes specifically, made for the Autobahn, can handle like the big fuel cell, is like reliable at that speed, has the distance. Like what does that have? Is that a twin turbo V8?
Yes.
In that? Are those being made anymore? It's all a bunch of four cylinders.
But you could buy one of those. You could. To use a new car.
But there's going to be no advancement.
E63 is just as good. There's advancement in horsepower for sure. Cars are not getting less powerful. They're just different.
But they're getting heavier and less efficient, potentially.
Heavy is not the disadvantage you would think it is on a Cannonball. We use heavy cars on purpose because then the suspension is beefier. They're made to handle their weight already. So when you add a few hundred pounds of fuel, it's not that big of a deal on a percentage basis. If you put a few hundred pounds of fuel into a regular sports car whose suspension is designed to be nimble and designed around a light car, all of a sudden you're like changing the fundamentals of that car. But you take a heavy Autobahn cruiser that's made to go 200 miles an hour with five people in it. Okay, well, you have three people and two people's worth of gas.
I just feel like the advancement, and that's why I do think it will be broken, is I am probably wrong and I'm thinking of things in an older mindset. But I just think all of the stuff that led Alex Roy and Ed and you and Arnie to set these records is just going to be different. And I think it's going to be much harder to go faster than you guys did.
Sure.
The average speed would also have to be nuts.
That's true. Every minute that is shaved off the Cannonball record makes it that much harder to shave another minute off. Right. And if you look at the curve over time of the Cannonball records, it's certainly a reverse hockey stick. So we're talking about likely incremental advances at this point. Now, we say that, but the last three records were like an hour apiece or more. I think it is possible for a number of reasons. I think there is still a conceivable situation where you can get low enough traffic levels based on a certain time you depart, day you depart, time of year, that you will have a similar advantage as during the pandemic. The algorithms and stuff in terms of when you should depart Manhattan have changed. The strategies have changed with the last few teams that have gone, and we've seen consistent repeated times that are faster. A number of non-record times, some sub 30 hours. There's also a lot of technology that's coming out on the anti-police side, like on the side of the Cannonballers, right? So there's always like kind of a scale that moves back and forth in terms of whether the cat or the mouse has the advantage in technology. And I think in the early 2000s or the 90s, the mouse had the advantage. And then laser came out and instant on radar and then the variable pulse rate laser, and that gave the cat the advantage. And I think it's moving back with a lot of the technology that's out there that it's in favor of the Cannonballers again. And there's some proprietary technology that I've seen that is really, really cool that I wish we had. That I think will be an advantage. But again, each of these pieces of technology is an incremental advantage, but it's also a distraction, right? Ed Bullion said it best that like every anti-police device you have in the car is just a reason for you to slow down, right? Because it's a false alert, a false alert, a false alert. So it's just giving you reasons to slow down instead of just driving fast. Arnie has said a bunch of times that he doesn't think it's possible to beat it using the same philosophy that we did it, essentially doing it safely and in a manner that doesn't affect or upset any other drivers. right? There's some people that want to do a balls to the wall type run where they're passing on shoulders and just complete disregard for everybody else on the road. That's not in the spirit of Cannonball, despite what the public perception may be. So, but I don't think that strategy actually works anyway, because you do that for too long and you're either going to wreck or get arrested. So there's just strategic advantage to not driving like a moron on a cannonball, as well as just not driving like a moron, because that's not what we do.
I think what a lot of people don't think about too, unless you're in the community, is that distance. So many things can happen. So many traffic jams, so many accidents.
That's correct.
So, maybe if you're driving an hour, going on the shoulder or making stupid maneuvers can make you faster. But over that amount of time, because you've mentioned a lot how like bathroom breaks and fuel stops like don't mean anything. You spent what, less than 25 minutes?
Yes.
On your
total
run?
Cumulative.
Wow. Yeah. Woohoo. Shave a minute off that. Like, yes, it's a minute lower, but like that's not where the gains are to be made.
Right. It's just driving faster, and driving faster at those speeds is, we'll just say it straight, it's incredibly dangerous. It has to be done with the utmost care. And the more cars are on the road, the harder that is to do, which that was the beauty of the pandemic, is that we could leave at a certain time that 2/3 of the drive, there was very few cars. We could maintain incredible cruising speeds without being a danger to anybody else, because there really wasn't anybody else. I think it can be beaten. I think it's going to be extremely hard, and it's going to take essentially a perfect run, which is what Ed Bullion talked about in his book. He thought it would take to beat his record. He was wrong, because we had a bunch of setbacks on our run. We still beat his record. Turns out we just needed to drive faster. But I think at this point, yes, you have to have just nothing go wrong in terms of outside variables. And that's very hard, like you said, across 2,800 miles. Like, the odds are just against you. I go to, like, Southern Ohio. I can't get there without a detour or some sort of slowdown or delay. So literally, I think everything has to go nearly perfectly. I think it is possible. And of course, the key here is just, anybody attempting it, you've got to uphold the record of safety. 120 years of transcontinental records and an unbroken safety record. This is not about just, throwing caution into the wind. This is about doing it properly. So I think it can be done. I'm sure it will be done at some point. I hope it isn't. I'd love to hold the record forever, but I think it can be done, and whoever does it, I think will have a whole new level of story to tell in terms of the planning, the algorithms, and the technology, and some new advantage that they've found. And that's the beauty of the Cannonball, is a constant innovation in all aspects of planning the record.
And now, lovely listeners, it is time for the Props and Flops, brought to you by Switch Cars. Switch Cars is the enthusiast's dealership where we buy, sell, consign, and that's all. There was another thing there previously, and I've just kind of, it's in my head. But we only do that to cars we like ourselves. So check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention Switchcast for special pricing. Find out more information on the beautifully redesigned switchcars.com or come visit our showroom in a lovely Twinsburg, Ohio. And Doug, what is our pick of the week?
Well, speaking of Cobalt Blue GT3s.
Oh no.
Yes, we have a Cobalt Blue 997.1 GT3, a 2008 with 65,000 miles. That's high mileage. Could be a Turo rental. Yes, if it was a 996, Tyler would be buying it, but it has the less ugly headlights, so, he can't do it.
Tyler
it also
wants
has
it.
Yes. Yeah. It also has ceramic brakes, full leather, a great maintenance history, and yeah, it's Cobalt Blue. We're asking $135,000. We do take trades. We do have finance options available, and we do ship all over the country. So the flop of the week, this is a little bit of an old story, but it's ongoing because there is now a lawsuit involved. A Dodge dealership and and the salesman have both been sued after a test drive ends badly. That's right. They were on a test drive with a Dodge Challenger RT Scat Pack. And there was an accident, and unfortunately it was a fatal one where there was an innocent victim. And the black box of the vehicle was pulled, and they were going 124 miles an hour and currently at wide open throttle in a 45 mile an hour zone, which appeared to be residential. Not the time nor the place to be doing those kinds of speeds. Now, some would argue that there's never a time or place for that, but that's a different discussion for a different day.
There's a spectrum of times and places. That's right. Really on the no side.
Right. Especially in a car you don't know. And yes, I'm assuming there was an intersection there because they just slammed into somebody. But yeah, 124 miles an hour, still under full throttle, complete disregard. The driver who was on the test drive had been arrested 25 times in the past for various charges, had multiple prior felonies, and he fled the scene but was arrested nearby.
How did this guy get this was a test drive, you said, right?
It was a test drive.
They run your license for these things.
License is not a background check.
I guess so.
So I don't know.
That's insane.
It sucks all around. We may unpack this story more at length in the future because there's so many things to unpack, but we may not because none of them are good. So I don't know. But that is the absolute flop of the week. Prop of the week. Speaking of Cannonball, there is a new Cannonball record, but it's not what you think. A man set a Cannonball ish record. He drove from the library in LA to the library of in New York. I think that's what you call bookends. And he set the record for the highest mile per gallon achieved in a brand new Prius, or the most recent generation. 93 miles per gallon.
Whoa.
Over 3,000 and change miles.
Some people average 93 miles an hour across the country. Some people average 93 miles per gallon across the country.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And he had a few tricks up his sleeve. So he specifically chose the base model because the Prime version has larger wheels, which give you worse mile per gallon. He overinflated the tires, so less rolling resistance, less grip, which you don't need grip if you're going slow. used only non-ethanol gas. I thought that was an interesting point, right?
Well, talk about route planning. How do you even find that?
Yeah, especially basically west of the Mississippi. I don't know. I mean, he probably filled up in California with jugs and made it to like Ohio on one tank. Yeah. And he serviced the brake system to make sure there was minimal resistance. So, you know, I don't really, like, lube the rotors up. And
Well, you don't need to stop that quickly if you're going slowly.
Don't need to stop at all. You're coasting. Yes. I think he also set a new record for the most amount of traffic jams created. Some people in the Cannonball community are questioning whether or not this is a real Cannonball. I think it's more like a cannon crawl. If anyone was watching his live stream, it would have been a tailgate party because of everybody tailgating him, hypermiling. I think it's cool. As much as I think hypermiling is kind of lame because it does just like tie up traffic and stuff like that, I do appreciate the challenge of it and the achievement of it. And so I do want to congratulate this gentleman, Wayne Gerdes, on his hypermiling journey. We found the story on Speed Society, which is an ironic place to carry this story. Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.